Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector. Hi, today I'm delighted to be joined by Maria Arpa, MBE, who's the founder of the Centre for Peaceful Solutions. Maria and I have known each other and worked together for some time now. And the work that she does in the areas of mediation, facilitation, dispute resolution, and so on is quite mind-blowing. So looking forward to this chat with Maria. Well, hello. Today I'm joined by Maria Arpa, who I guess it probably doesn't sound great, but I'm going to say is an old friend. But I hope that comes across in the right way. Maria and I first did some work together back in 2013, when I think was the first time you visited us here at Wellington.
That's right, yeah. I came in for a meeting.
Yeah.
And having spent a lot of the time working in the charity and going into prisons, this was rather different surroundings.
There are those that suggest boarding schools are akin to prisons, but here in Crowthorne, we have two great Victorian institutions that were set up, Wellington College here and Broadmoor, just across the road there. So, but Maria, it's great to have you here today. Great to be able to reconnect, and we're going to be able to talk through a few things today that I think are quite pertinent for both of us.
I think, and
for the sector as a whole. So, a lot of chat at the moment about education. If you look at the world as a whole, people are saying, well, education is going to change irrevocably, I'll even get that out. across the world, many people saying that education is going to change irrevocably because of AI. And we've had the CEO of Duolingo saying that AI is already a better teacher than any human. And I'm curious, as we start to explore this today, you know, what are your thoughts about the way education is going right now, and where do you think it should go?
So that's really interesting, because I'm probably going to take a sort of back route to answer the question. But my daughter and her husband are academics, and you know, on walking around the campus with them, I remember saying, you know, all this will be gone, don't you? You know, all this will be digitised. And then when it's digitised, no one will have to actually attend a physical building like this. And they were rather horrified at this suggestion, which I made several years ago. But we can see moving towards that bit by bit. So when I hear you say, you know, AI will be and is a better teacher than any human, I think we have to start with, well, what is it we're teaching?
Yeah, exactly. And that definitely resonates with me as an educator, having spent my entire life in education. Yeah, the notion that somehow a bot of some sort could be better than all of the incredible people that I've had the opportunity to work with, that maybe grates a little bit. So I understand I've got a bit of an agenda. So what should we be teaching young people as they go through school?
That's a really interesting question. So when I think about that, I think there are two distinct things that young people, children, you know, who are entering the world, two tracks, and they need to work hand in hand. And the first one is the obvious one. What is the knowledge that we need to stuff them with in order that they can grow up and go into this crazy world we've created and find some way of navigating it without getting in too much trouble, actually maybe thrive, maybe find success.
Yeah.
So that I don't have any problem with. And I think we do that reasonably well, or there's enough really good institutions, people, craftsmen, you know, there's enough of that around to make that really good and worthwhile. The other thing that I believe we ought to be teaching children is community, the work of the soul.
Yeah.
What is the impact I have on myself and others? Mm. And also, do I even like the system I'm being prepared for, and how would I change it? So creativity, energy, frequencies, being around others, living from the soul and the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. And that sounds an incredibly rich combination of those two things. And if we start with the second one, I think we can come back to the knowledge maybe a little bit later, but this whole idea of connection and energy is something that really comes up a lot. I'm also a coach and a coach trainer, as you know, and how we enable people to connect with their most powerful energy and to connect with the energy of others in that way. So the first word you used was community.
Mm-hmm.
And in your work, maybe you could just expand a little bit on what you've seen that's been really, really powerfully positive in people's lives in the sense of community.
So whenever you put a group of people together, whether that's a family, whether it's an institution, whether it's the school or, you know, even, you know, the local GP, you know, wherever there's a group of people, there are going to be tensions and disagreements. And there's going to be lots of gifts and lots of giving and service.
Yeah.
And it's a whole melting pot.
Yeah.
And so my work is about helping people understand that when tensions arise, it will probably lead to conflict.
Mm.
Conflict leads to disputes. And that the way we manage this, the way that we navigate conflict, the way that we navigate how we're going to be together actually does not serve us.
Mm.
And so I like to go in and give communities the skills. So rather than being parachuted in every time to try and resolve issues as some sort of expert third party, what I like to do is go in and say, look, you, there's a whole set of skills here that you need and a whole system and process that we can build into this community so that you can become more agile, more eloquent and more precise about how we have those conversations and what we want out of it at the other end.
And what are some of those skills that, because I think that you've highlighted a really obvious dissonance there between you. So you tend to be called in as a parachuted in expert more often than maybe people being proactive and going, hang on, how do we want this community to be? And therefore, how do we grow this community from the beginning in a way that serves the needs of the members of it? So if you could be used in a much more proactive way in terms of developing, what do you develop in people?
So there's the individual and the group. Mm. So a really good example of that is the work I do in prisons.
Mm.
And that would be taking a group of prisoners and giving them the skills of the model that I created, which is called the Dialogue Roadmap. And we can come on to that a bit later. Yeah. And then the prisoners, firstly, they've got to deal with their own inner conflicts because you can only love another human being to the extent that you love yourself. Once you hit that barrier, you can't be of service.
Mm.
And in fact, you may be using other people around you to try and heal yourself, which is a dangerous place to be. Mm. So firstly, they work individually on their own stuff.
Mm.
And then they have to work as a team. So they've got to deal with the little disputes. You know, if you put a group of people together in a team, you've got 10, 12 people, there are going to be disagreements.
Yeah.
And sometimes they have to stop what they're doing and spend a week at realigning themselves as they see the tensions are building in a group, because it's really hard to do this work in a prison.
Yeah.
And then what happens is we end up with a team of prisoners who are running an in-house service for all the prisoners who are struggling.
Mm.
So what does that do? It increases trust.
Yeah.
It takes a burden off of the system. It then reduces the amount of violence and it gives people a place to go. So prisoners who are struggling get the opportunity to explain why they're struggling to someone who's also a prisoner.
Yeah.
So who isn't making notes.
Yeah.
and it isn't going to go down on their record.
And isn't sitting in judgment.
And isn't sitting in any judgment. And so, I mean, we did an 8-year project in Dartmoor Prison, which became one of the safest jails in the prison estate. And in fact, one of the statistics that really enthused me was the lads were doing so many one-to-ones with people struggling that they actually, the amount of mediations needed got down to zero. So some of my team never actually got to mediate.
Really? Yeah.
Because they were sorting it out at the source before it translated into bad behaviour.
Yeah. And that really resonates for me because one of the very first things you taught me when we first did some work together was the absolute necessity of enabling people to feel heard, and where an awful lot of where conflicts become disputes, it really stems from that major issue.
Absolutely. So I say there are only three conflict messages in the world. The first one is two people in an argument, and you can hear this. Now, when I give you this, you can hear it everywhere you go, in the news, everywhere. And the first conflict message is two people going, you changed to suit me. No, you changed to suit me. No, you changed to suit me. No, you changed to suit me. And the second conflict message, which tends to happen more in families, is I'm worse off than you. No, I'm worse off than you. No, you don't understand how badly off I am. No, 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 you don't get it. But actually beyond that, there is only one conflict message, and that is I need to know I matter. And one way we can show people they matter is to listen and be a safe container where a person can be seen and heard and understood. Doesn't necessarily mean I agree. Doesn't necessarily mean I condone. Doesn't necessarily mean that I'm on the same path as you. But the first point for any human being is to believe that they matter to somebody. And I've done a lot of gang work, okay? I've done a lot of threat to life stuff. And what I can tell you is when people feel they have nothing to lose, then they will resort to any means. And although that's at the gang level, that happens in organisations and institutions. And it's nothing to do with wealth. It's nothing to do with physical or material wealth. So if I feel I've got nothing to lose, then I can resort to anything to get heard.
And when you feel you don't matter, then you definitely are going to be much more likely to feel you've got nothing to lose.
We do. I mean, when we're at our most needy, when we're at our most desperate in terms of wanting to be heard and understood, we will act in ways that are least likely to get us heard and understood.
Absolutely. And that something comes up for me there as you say that, hearing as one young person I heard in a school not so long ago who said, the school doesn't care about us, it's just a marketing machine. And then, you know, you also, there are examples where the metrics on which a school is judged become the metrics tail that wags the education dog. And if you, I know it's been said a few times that as soon as a measurement becomes a target, it ceases to become a useful measurement. And I'm just curious about, you know, when we look at education, what education needs to be, how much... that has maybe been a part of the education going down maybe a different alleyway where it becomes instrumentalist rather than a function of growth. I mean, we're in the business of growing people in education. That's what we do.
So that's really interesting. I mean, God, I could spend a day unpacking that statement. It doesn't care about us. It's a marketing machine. And I could understand how a person might say that. I can understand how anyone could look and say, oh, you don't care about me. I don't think it's as brutal as it's a marketing machine. What I see is that organisations and institutions they're like a machine, and the machine needs to turn. And so, you know, there is... I'll make it specific to schools. Mm. Okay, so a school needs to get a student from A to B.
Yeah,
and generally it's pretty well thought out. I mean, you know, it's not all terrible.
No,
it's generally well thought out. There are clever people who know what they're doing, who've been doing this for ages. Where it runs into a problem for me, you know, I've been going into schools sort of independently since 2001.
Yeah.
So I've seen a variety of schools. Where it runs into problems is that the desperation to get that student from A to B means that no institution is ever going to allow one person or one small group of people to put a spanner in the works. It's just not, because the cost. So even if it isn't about marketing, and even if it isn't about tests and exams and you know, and success as you know, the warped version of success. Even if it isn't about that, how can you? I mean, I wouldn't want to run a school. I mean, how would I couldn't even think about how you would manage all those different people in all those different places on all those different days with all the employment and all, you know, it's an unbelievable thing that a school can open every day and function. Right? So I wanna look at the enormity and then I wanna look at, it can't possibly let one person or one small group of people put a spanner in the works and grind it to a halt because of the cost, emotional, physical, employment law, legal, you know, all the cost of that on an enormous scale. So that I get. Where it fails for me is that alongside that, in parallel, and this is what I do in communities, you need another process that says every now and again someone wants to be heard. Every now and again someone's going to act out. Every now and again someone's trauma point is going to get triggered. These are natural things of putting people together. Every now and again we've got diverse people, diverse cultures, diverse states of being in the world. I mean, God, we could have a whole conversation about this idea of neurodiversity. For me, it's just people are different. Like, so it's about, okay, maybe what we've done is we've created standardized containers. And now what we have to do is just broaden those containers. And it's been long fought for. So for me, you have to have a second track of a place where people can go and not come out and say, you don't care about me, it's a marketing machine. A place. And if you don't build that in, the organisation will pay for it. And so will the individuals going through that system. Does that, that was a bit long, but does it make sense?
Absolutely. And several things emerged from that. I think one is the quite significant body of varied bits of research that point to the value of an adult in a young person's life who's not part of the family unit, but an adult who believes in them, who cares about them, who champions them, who encourages them, who inspires them. There's some positive impact that is there. And if a young person can go through their whole school experience and not have had that, there's significant less likelihood of them finding fulfillment and purpose and so on in their life. So that was a big thing that came out of what you just said.
Well, that really lands for me. So, you know, I've researched my topic a lot, you know, and I've very practically on the ground applied it, you know, and all the rest of it. And, you know, where I come to now is I'm really looking at ancient wisdom, indigenous wisdom, First Nations people, and not what they've become through colonization, but what came before. And I find a lot of inspiration in that. And so one of the questions that arises is, who are your wisdom keepers? So we don't discuss that. Your wisdom keepers are not the housing association, the housing officer. Your wisdom keepers are not the headmaster of the school. Your wisdom keepers are not necessarily people with job titles who are also invested in the system. So where do we find our wisdom keepers? And it's been a really big question for me. And my wisdom keepers are people in my life. Yeah. Like, I might call you a wisdom keeper for me. And Ian Morris in this school. You know, there are a number of people I know, but not because of your job title, but because of the depth of what I can resonate in your soul.
Yeah. And that definitely resonates for me in terms of people's personal values. So it isn't about title or status or influence or power or something like that. But on what level do I connect with somebody on the basis of shared values and things that matter?
And whose wisdom would I trust, you know, when I need it most? And not just people that agree with me, not echo chambers, but who would I be able to go to and say, I've got this dilemma in my life. You know, how would you, you know, knowing me the way you know me, and who might say, well, you want to think about it like this, and it might be nothing to do with the way I think.
Totally. And I think that's a brilliant example of how shared values give us a moral compass and like a framework through which we can make decisions. But different perspectives through those values help us to find better decisions, better, firstly, a wider range of options, and secondly, an ability to come to a better course of action, which that definitely kind of jumps out at me. And I must also say something else that you said a moment ago, that so as the father of the most wonderful autistic young man, our younger son is 27 now, and this whole concept of neurodiversity, and you use the idea of there being containers, convenient containers into which we put people, there does seem to be really right across the sector now a much greater appreciation of one entire continuum of humanity rather than there being categories within that. I honestly the more I've learned about this, and the more I've kind of connected with people, the more I think, I don't think I've ever met anyone who's not even a tiny bit autistic, and nor I've ever met anyone who, you know, we're all part of the same continuum. And when we first found that Dougie was autistic back in, it was just before his third birthday, I can remember the consultant psychologist saying, when you look back through the family trees of autistic children, you sometimes find evidence of obsessive behaviours. And I remember Cress and I looked at each other and just burst out laughing. It's like, it is a miracle that the entire family tree is not. And I think that gave rise to some wisdom and the clarity of thinking, and the perspective that Dougie brings to everyday life means that he is the best antidote to a bad day ever. Because it just melts away. So just a really interesting personal resonance for me, what you said about the convenience and that maybe the fallacy of this kind of containerized approach to categorizing people.
And you see, I don't blame people for going down that route.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, when you're out in sort of, you know, the majority of community and you're talking about schools, unless you've had your child statemented by an educational psychologist, you can't access extra services. Yeah. So, of course, people are queuing up to get their child a statement so they can access services that should be available, just should be available, because we're human and we need support.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly enough, you know, if you really want to go down this route, there's a great book called The Myth of Mental Illness by Thomas Szasz. Which points to the continuum of humanity and the idea that if you start creating titles and diagnoses for people, you're just what you're doing is you're narrowing the bandwidth of people that can fit into a system that actually can't accommodate. And that, for me, I mean, I feel very passionate about the mainstream education system, because it doesn't say, look, we've only got so many resources and we need a stream, a river of kids coming through who are just obedient and compliant and can pass five GCSEs at grades A to C, so we can sort of tick that box. And actually, we can't accommodate anything outside of that bandwidth. Mm. But what it says instead is if you don't fit into that bandwidth, there's something wrong with you. And that is a terrible, terrible thing to do to an entire society.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's probably a whole different podcast episode on that, which we come to. Just maybe to go back to the beginning, one of the things you talked about, the two things that ought to be present in education, you started with knowledge. If there's a criticism of education systems in this country and in other parts of the world, it has been that it's been too much about the imparting of and then the regurgitation of knowledge, which I think is a ridiculously simplistic way of looking at what actually goes on in classrooms and what teachers actually do. And I think it's quite demeaning actually to the profession, but it does tend to be quite a repeated thing. There's a new paradigm, if you like, in education that's starting to be talked about an awful lot, which is this idea of human flourishing being the ultimate purpose of what we do. And this again might develop into an entire conversation. For some of the naysayers, they would say, what, so you're going to stop teaching stuff? Are you going to stop teaching knowledge and getting qualifications just to teach people to flourish? Almost, you know, taking a pejorative perspective on the word flourish, that it's flowery and it's all a little bit impractical. I think the most compelling descriptions of what flourishing means really include foundational, you talked about foundational knowledge, stuff that people need to know in order to be able to navigate an increasingly changeable world. I'm curious just to explore a little bit, for you, this word flourishing, are we better to talk about thriving? What are your views on education's current conversation in that area of like, what is our purpose?
Oh, this touches me in so many places, because my instant reaction to, flourishing and thriving is, how are we going to make the shifts in our rigid mainstream society to accommodate all these flourishing people? Because the truth is, if you want to send people out into the world who are creative and flourishing and can think and can challenge things, but challenge things in a sensible and intelligent way, and who can change the game of life, who's going to empty the dustbins? And this is a very interesting question. Who would then want to clean our toilets? Who then wants to empty the drains? So what's the balance there? Because what we've done with the Industrial Revolution, which is where this education system came from, it was designed by industrialists, and it was designed to take people out of the fields where they were in harmony with nature and get them into factories where you had to be obedient to the clock, you had to be obedient to rules, and you had to work within certain parameters and just do, you know, you ripped away the joy of seeing something all the way through, as you would have done in the fields. You would sow the seeds, you would water, you know, and then you'd harvest.
Yeah.
But what you said is, no, all you're going to do is you're going to just bang on this machine 3,000 times an hour or whatever it is. And you said to people, you're going to do that one repetitive task and you're replaceable. So you're actually worthless. That's what it was all about. And so what I hear when you say flourishing is, how are we going to change that, turn that tide on that? But you still need people coming out. What are we going to do, import them from other countries? You know, it's so complicated.
Yeah.
We've created such a a world of so many complexities when actually life is actually really simple.
Yeah.
You know, I've been working with a community that live in the forest, and it's been absolutely marvelous to watch people who have decided to live in the forest, not in the UK, of course, and who know how to use resources well.
Yeah.
So they don't need to earn X amount of money because they have to have the latest, you know, whatever digital TV thing.
Mm.
They're close to the ground. They're living in harmony with nature. But like I said, who's going to sweep the streets? It's got a complexity that I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
So I then go, well, it's no good going into overwhelm.
Mm.
What is the one bit I can do? What's the one bit we can do together?
Yeah.
And that still comes back to there's a sense of community, a sense of belonging. There's gifting, contribution, receiving. Mm. And you can teach me maths all you like. Yeah. You can teach me history and teach me anything you like, but that learning needs to be enshrined with these other things. So, and I'm going to say one more thing and then I'll shut up for a minute. The thing that bothers me is how much we test kids.
Mm.
And it's really interesting because people get so indoctrinated into everything's a test that when you try and talk to people in jobs, everything's a test. Their whole nervous system is, why are you asking me that in a workplace? You know, is this a test?
Yeah.
Have I got to give the right answer? Because they've been so programmed into that. And the nonsense of it is we put kids on a track and we say, you have to pass that test on your own, unaided, in a box in a certain amount of time.
Mm.
But if I go out into industry, I don't have to make those decisions on my own. I get advisors.
Mm,
I pay people to come and help me.
Mm,
I work in collaboration.
Yeah, and I think that points to, you know, some of the kind of issues that we're facing, where if it's often said that if you can't measure something, then it's not worth doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in education, what that leads to a lot of the time is things that are incredibly complicated and really quite hard to measure. Instead of ignoring those, what people tend to do is let's find something we can measure and use it as proxy to measure the thing we can't measure. Because and of course, if the only thing you can actually reliably measure is quite narrow, that can reduce the breadth of education really quite significantly. And again, this might lead us on to a longer conversation in a subsequent episode, but one of the most compelling things about what Michael Stevenson has done in creating the OECD's new framework for human flourishing is not just being able to describe, well, what does it mean to flourish, and how do you create those conditions where the foundational knowledge and the foundational skills and the competencies lead towards people and it's young people in our schools as much as it is the adults who are looking after the young people in our schools all needing the same thing, the way in which they can not only develop into flourishing individuals, but also how can we actually assess that, you know, whether it's working or not, and so on. So you know, I think there's some really interesting stuff there. But it strikes me that we're getting quite close towards the end of this one. And we ought to.
We've only just begun.
And just maybe to pick out a few thoughts from this first session. We've really had a fascinating ramble through some really quite deep topics, and we'll maybe pick up on one or two of those in subsequent episodes. But if you come down to this fundamental purpose of what should we teach in schools, what should we be teaching young people, two big things have really alighted. It's about community and it's about knowledge for you. And I wonder whether you just want to round up your own thoughts on that.
Yeah, thank you. So isn't it interesting, you know, I talk about community, soul, frequencies, energies, being around others, the impact they have on me, the impact I have on everybody. And so for me, we can demonstrate that by the way that we run our community and by the way we deal with conflict, by the way that we have disagreement, by the way that we allow a variety of ideas and opinions to take root. And then by a process of dialogue, we can decide what goes forward and what doesn't, but everybody can get heard somewhere, okay? So that for me is, you can really measure that. You can measure the impact and the changes and the resilience of a community by its ability to navigate those conflict and tense moments and the pressure cookers that arise. And then when it comes to knowledge, I mean, I'm no expert in that and I don't really have much to say. What I can say is, for me, I would revisit some of the stuff that we've just traditionally taught. History is a great one for me because, I mean, we teach a history, but history is not one truth, is it? And who's written that history? And then what happens when you start looking at things like the Indigenous history and that's completely omitted? And is it good enough to just have, you know, Black History Month as if that's not part of a whole history? You know, making a nod to things. And what's useful? Because for me, knowledge, I would be asking myself, is this knowledge that we want kids to learn and impress upon them and have understanding and be able to use, is it going to be useful for them to enter the world?
And that begs the big question of, is education a means to an end or an end in itself?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, education itself for me is lifelong, isn't it? I mean, well, hang on. No, let me change that. Education is a strategy to meet the human need for learning. And learning starts from the moment you're born. I mean, it probably starts inside the womb, but, you know, but learning is continuous. It is not a tap that you turn on and off. Learning is a very basic human need. And knowledge, education, teaching, schools, further education, they're all just responses to that human need. And I think the first question is, have we got it right?
And maybe we can explore that in the next episode. So for the moment, Maria, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Gosh, it's been amazing. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you. Well, that was fascinating. And a breathless ramble through some really exciting topics in education and well beyond. I wonder what your reflections are as you listen to that. If the two things that we should be teaching young people are knowledge and community, I wonder what emerges for you. If you found any of these conversations interesting, and I'm sure you have, we're delighted to have Maria coming to work with us next term on the 27th of January. She's doing a session on addressing staff room conflicts. And on the 24th of March, another really crucial one on managing relationships with parents. Do get in touch with us at The Bridge if you're interested in taking part in these. Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.